Well, I just hope you should be able to start the discussion. And I mean, there are many questions about how the streets relate to migration. But okay, let's start the discussion. Okay, Sabina and Victoria, do we want to collect or do you want to collect questions?
Actually, two brief insights. The one is from what you are explaining now, it would be completely clear that the thesis of the end of history is something that only happened in this zone of being. And therefore, from the initiation zone of the known being, this is nonsense. So I don't know if you have some thoughts on that regard. And the other insight would be like, actually, because I would be very keen with your argument about concepts and epistemic structures, hierarchies, I would like also to be more radical in the sense not trying to claim also for using to legitimize some types of social organization or thought to use these Western categories like philosophy or democracy, because that would be also like again reproducing as you are showing the same structure of categories. For me it would be also important to say, although it is not philosophy because it's not attached to that particular history of ideas, but that doesn't mean that we should also claim for that name to that it's also like a political that would be
like
political
democracy
claim.
Philosophy
is exactly democracy is the same thing.
Yeah, this is more of a pragmatic question, sort of as an ethnographer. You're researching situations. How does one know, like in a very pragmatic situation, who is inside the zone of being and who is outside of it? And I assume that you can read it from power relations. You see this happening. But I wonder, you know, how flexible is it? How situational is it? Can the same group be in one situation in the zone of being and then flip into another situation in the zone of non-being? I'm more sort of interested in the, you know, pragmatic markers that help someone read the situation.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Let me say the following. First, term social democracy or term social philosophy. I want to claim those terms because the part of the narrative of Eurocentrism is to make us believe that all these terms are naturally and inherently European. And that's historically false. Because the fact is that the same way Europe stole a lot of wealth from the South, they also stole a lot of knowledge from the South that later on became coin as if it is naturally and inherently European and is part of Eurocentric modernity. And then it flies around the world as some kind of a global universal project that nobody else has. Okay? Like nobody else has democracy, nobody else has human rights, nobody else has notions of equality or things like this. Okay? And this is very problematic because it's in a sense, part of decolonizing historiography will imply to show how many of the narratives that we take for granted as Western are really, really part of a more complex encounter of the West with the rest. And how a lot of the things that we take for granted as inherently and naturally Western are really things that are coming from many parts of the world and have been, in a sense, appropriated as part of the European tradition, but appropriated in an ontological way. That is, naturally, inherently European, and the rest have nothing of that. That's part of the colonial project, to not only appropriate wealth, but appropriate also knowledges in other places, you know, and then recycle them as some kind of European, you know, as a colonial global design and as part of colonial projects, of civilizational projects, etc. But to give you just an example, the word democracy. First of all, the idea that Greek civilization, 5 centuries before Christ, is part of Europe, is really very problematic jump, okay? Because if you look, for example, the work of Martin Bernal, Black Athena, for example, he shows with overwhelming evidence at all levels, including linguistic evidence, how that part of the world, 5 centuries before Christ, was a crossover of Persian, Egyptian, Phoenician civilizations. And he shows a lot of continuities from those other civilizations into Plato, Aristotle, all the Greeks. First, the word democracy, for example, is an Egyptian word. It's not even a Greek word. It's a word that comes from Egypt. Okay? And at that moment, Egypt was pretty much influenced by Bantu civilization. So these are things that get buried in history, because what happened is when the West constructed its superiority over the rest after 1492, part of what was part of the project was to also construct a narrative that will be accordingly, you know, coherent with this idea of the West superior, the rest inferior. That narrative, that being in the 16th century, as I explained yesterday, but it becomes consolidated with the idea that Europe has an origin, and this is an invention of the 17th, 18th century, that Europe has an origin in Greek civilization, and then they trace back the history of Europe back to the Greeks. But then, what happened in between? Then you have the Roman Empire, but then there is a period there that people call, in Eurocentric historiography, the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages. What is that? That's nonsense. Dark Ages, Middle Ages, that's nothing. You're just putting something there to because you don't want to really put a name to that. Okay. And what is the name to that? It's Islam. That's what you want to hide. Okay. Now, instead of saying we have a huge debt with Islam, we say Dark Ages, Middle Ages. Okay? And then we raise Islam from the picture, and then we bring the Greeks all the way to Europe as a linear history, you know, from then. But that's Islam. We got the Greek philosophers through the Islamic philosophers. That's how they got here, you know? And they were the ones who were taking seriously that Greek tradition when in Europe, in what we call Europe, quote unquote, okay, today, that was Christendom, you would be burned alive, okay, if you were caught with the book of Aristotle. Okay? That was the reality of the time. That's the Dark and Middle Ages. Okay? And they cannot name it. You see, because then it would be, they will have to acknowledge the debt with Islam. The debt with Islam in astronomy, in medicine, in philosophy, in all the science you can imagine. Okay? The Islamic civilization knew that the world was not the center of the universe 800 years before the Europeans, in the school of Baghdad. Okay? 800 years before the Europeans. Europeans arrived to that 800 years later, in the 17th century. Okay? Because at the time, you would be burned alive if you questioned that idea. Galileo was burned alive. So, this tells you something about the invention of Europe. We talk about the invention of America, the invention of Africa. Well, this is the invention of Europe. You have to invent a history that is a fictional history that then you ontologize it to make it seem believable, no? And make it real, no? And so that's why I refuse I refuse the idea of not using this term, because I would be then giving up on the myth, you see? And I don't want to give up on that myth. I want to say, listen, democracy is a concept that has been there, you know, beyond the boundaries of Europe, and the idea that is inherently European is a false idea. This is not European. That's why the Zapatistas say we are democratic too, and we have commanding Wallobin and the Caracoles as the way to think about democracy in Toho Laval cosmology. And that's a form of democracy, because in our form of democracy, whoever commands will be the community, and whoever obeys the community commands. So it's commanding one of being, which is different from liberal democracy, where you command, you don't obey, you obey, you don't command. That's the response of the indigenous community in south of Mexico. Now, who are we to say you're not democratic? Or that's not a form of democracy when you have the community deciding collectively over their affairs, okay? You see? And so they refuse to fall into the Bin Laden Islamic fundamentalism of saying, okay, democracy is a Western construct. Well, I'm saying that Eurocentric fundamentalism is the worst form of fundamentalism in the world today, not only because it has the military, institutional, epistemic, and political means to impose its epistemic sexist racism around the world, but also because, and I'm going to say now something quite controversial, because it's the one that has produced everything we call as fundamentalists, such as Afrocentric fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism, indigenous fundamentalism. What do I mean by that? Epistemically, if you watch carefully, what we call fundamentalists are variations of Eurocentrism. Bin Laden is a Eurocentric. He thought, he takes the binaries of Eurocentric thinking, that is, we, the West, are naturally inherently democratic. You, the non-West, are naturally inherently authoritarian. We, the West, are naturally inherently for women's rights. You, the non-West, are naturally inherently patriarchal. We, the West, are naturally inherently for freedom and liberty. You, the non-West, are naturally inherently for authoritarian and oppression. Right? What is his answer? Yes, you're right, that's a Western project, I don't want it, and mine, patriarchal, the caliphate, authoritarian, whatever, is superior to yours. That's his point. He's taking the binary, accepting the binary, and he's just inverting it. You see the point? He's not questioning the binary. And that's why I'm saying that's a form of Eurocentrism inverted. Because he's taking the binary of the West and just inverting it, leaving it intact. When you look at responses from other places, like from the Aymaras, from the Toho Laval, from political Buddhism, from other places, they don't accept those premises. They don't say, oh, democracy is yours, mine is other thing, a kingdom, authoritarian. No, they say, we have four democracy that are different from yours, and institutionally different. And so they break the binary. You see? And that breaking of the binary is a fundamental move that I want to keep. You see? In terms of your question, you were saying...
how to recognize...
Okay, how to recognize. So, this goes to the question of migration that I didn't have the time to develop, but it's in the readings. That then, how do we think about migrants, okay, and migration today? In terms of what we discuss, zone of being, non-being, all this stuff. Well, what I've done is to develop a conceptualization for migration that allows to think in terms of disentanglement. For example, one thing we need to look at is there are different paths of incorporation when you have migrants coming from one place to another. You have those that after a few generations become part of the dominant group of the society, that become westernized, or in other places part of the white groups, okay, or part of the westernized groups. Okay? You have other people who come, and doesn't matter how much generation they're in the place, they're still kept as non-Western. Even four generation, fifth generation, born and raised in the place, they're still questioned: is they're really Germans, or they're really French, or they're really Americans? Still, there are people questioning if Obama is an American citizen. Look at this: McCain, who was his opposite. Remember, in 2008, McCain, the Republican, he was born in Panama Canal. That's not a state of the United States. Nobody dared to question he was really an American citizen. But with Obama, who was born in Hawaii, under a state of the United States, it's still questioned. Still today, the debate is ongoing. Okay? So it tells you something, no, about these questions. And so I prefer to use terms like colonial racial subjects of empire. These are people who have been here for a long time, like in the case of Europe, gypsies or other groups, you know, that have been here for a long time, has been inferiorized inside the territory, or in the United States, indigenous people or African American have been colonized there for a long term process. Okay, I call them the colonial racial subjects of empire. And then you have the people who become westernized migrants, who are the ones who get incorporated and assimilated to the mainstream, and they leave the privilege of whiteness or the privilege of westernization. Okay? And then you have some groups in between that I prefer to call colonial migrants, because these are people, although they were never really directly colonized by the empire where they migrated, they're still racialized like colonial racial subjects of the empire in similar ways. So you have the extrapolation of the categories used with colonial racial subjects of the empire to the new immigrants. Okay? And then they're classified together with the inferior subjects in the zone of non-being. So I use this conceptualization to break down the mythology of immigrant. Because immigrant is a category that could be tricky, because immigrant, you know, doesn't tell you anything exactly about what is going on. So I prefer to use categories like that that break down the idea of homogeneity inside migrant, you see, and break it down into different experiences of incorporation. And that way, you account for success and failure. You see, you could see the more successful, usually they tend to be those who tend to become part of the mainstream or assimilated as part of whiteness or westernized. You see, the less successful are those who happen to be considered part of the non-West. And it doesn't matter how many generations are there, there's still question about if they're really, really German, they're really, really American, they're really, really French. No? And so on. So I prefer to do that. Then you bring gender there, and then it becomes even more complex. Because then, with gender and race, the two together, then it becomes very complex. Because then the experience of incorporation of a woman that is westernized, a woman migrant who is westernized, will be different from a woman migrant who happened to be in the non-West. The experience of incorporation of a non-Western male migrant is going to be also different from a non-Western woman migrant. And so you have all these articulations that are expressed in the political economy. I mean, this is not something that is a classificatory thing that is artificial. If you look at the demographic and you look where they are placed in the division of labor, you could see very clearly this articulation between race, gender, and class in complex ways with the migrant population. And so this is the way I would go about it. And you could see that in demographic indicators from there all the way till the way they are perceived, you know, and the kind of narratives that are hegemonic about those groups in the society and things like that, you know. So this is the way I will suggest. So this is a translation of everything I said here into migration theory and stuff.
Migration, also a colonial struggle. I mean, in what you're saying, gender is kind of only the object of the system, in a way.
Yes, absolutely. That's why.
Yeah.
In one of the essays, I believe it was, I talk about Latinos and the colonization of the U.S. empire in the 21st century. Because what happened is that also these migrants and these they're also questioning the hegemonic ways of defining many things. And so you have also, together with attempts at colonizing this population, there is also the agency of this population that is also struggling for the decolonization of this metropolitan spaces. And so these are things that are ongoing. And if you watch the article that I suggested to read for today, you could see there how there are demographic shifts, for example, to give the example of the United States, where in the next 30 years, white American populations are going to become a minority, demographic minority, you see, and you have the minorities becoming the majority, especially the Latinos, the Latino population growing in a fast and significant way. And so now you have a struggle about what is the future of American society. Is this going to continue with new forms of apartheid, like it's right now, where you have 1 million black, 1 million Latinos choose in jails, in prisons, okay? And where you have policing of communities, the zone of non-being, no, where democratic rights and civil rights are not acknowledged, there's still violence in everyday life. Okay, are you going to build a society like this, where now you have a large majority, demographic majority that is expelled, okay, and you have a minority, demographic minority, white American running the show. Is this where we're going? Or are we going to move beyond that and then build something different? And then that will entail decolonizing the structures of power of American society. And these are the dilemmas that we're facing today in the U.S., but not only in the U.S., here in Europe, in the old Europe, no? This is where you have these struggles also going on. And look at the debate about Islam today, in Europe today. This is a debate about precisely the same questions, about a colonial Europe vis-a-vis a decolonial Europe. Look at the debates about why Turkey cannot enter, no? While you have French Guiana and Martinique as part of the European community, okay? Which are far away in the Caribbean, colonies of France. And then they are part of the European community, they are recognized. But then Turkey is here, next door, okay? Has been, in many ways, if you look historically, more European than many territories today inside the European community, and is expelled because they are Muslims, no? Muslim, you cannot be European if you are Muslim. Because what is Europe? Oh, Christendom. Christendom. So here comes again the hierarchy, the religious hierarchy coming on in to constitute superiority, inferiority, who belongs, who doesn't belong. Look at that. Now, that doesn't make any sense, because if you watch the formation of European community, it's supposed to be a secular space. It's not supposed to be Christian Europe. But that's exactly where it goes down. It's about Christian Europe, because what happened is behind the secular argument is that Christian cosmology is still informing the way we think about the world. Despite the declaration, we're atheists, we don't believe in God anymore, we're this, we're that, well, Christian cosmology is still in your head, okay? And we need to acknowledge that. Because we all think within cosmology. There's nobody outside of cosmology. But the pretension of Western male thinking is that they're thinking from nowhere. I will explain that tomorrow. But the pretension is as if they were thinking from a God-eye view, no particular, no cosmological or religious kind of constitution in their thinking. Well, I'm sorry, but if you look carefully, the narrative that we carry on are secularization of Christian narratives. Okay, that still with us.
I would try to have my question, if I may. I'm waiting already half an hour for this. I find it very exciting what you've said, but I have two, let's say, more concrete questions. I'm a historian, and that's why I'm somewhere imprisoned in my discipline in a certain way. So the first question would be, as far as I understood you, it's very simplifying what you've said, but in 1492, bad guys are coming out, Europeans, and they somewhere conquer the whole world. And then from this point we have this kind of colonialism and modernity together, all the system, what you've said, explained, it's very interesting. But I would ask, and I miss here a puzzle, why this system became so successful? Successful in a sense, how is it possible? What are the reasons? What are the factors which led to this coming out, expulsion, or not expulsion, but conquering of the world, and it still works? It's still there today. And then I would say this might be a comparative view if we are comparing the culture potentials or the potentials or the factors of European culture before 1482 with other cultures parallelly. That might be that we somewhere find an answer to this question, because, okay, they came and they colonized the world, but from where they came, from which kind of culture, which elements are there, which habits are there, behaviors are there. This is the first issue. So I miss this, what was before 1492. The second is, for me, it's very interesting what you say about Europe, but what I would ask for a more detailed Europe view, because I'm coming from Eastern Europe, and my country
not nation, or my region, I'm coming from Central Europe, has not actually a historical experience with colonialism. And between colonialism, or different, there are different types of colonialism, colonialistic experiences also in Europe. You have the British part, the British way of colonialism, but you have also the Turkish, Ottoman way of colonialism, which is not Western, male, and etc., etc., Christian. Where the Russian in 19th century, I would differ a bit, or maybe compare them to have a more, yeah, this is what I've missed now, this a bit more detailed view about Europe.
I don't know, you want to say something?
Well, it would tie into questions that I would have, because it's a spiritual category, actually. And you're saying Christianity versus non-Christianity.
Christendom
entails Protestant and Catholic. That ties into the question of where Orthodox Christianity remains. And then, of course, Orthodox Christianity has this other kind of difference that's not colonial difference, but it's an imperial difference.
Yeah.
Only that it has a different history. And just as much as Spain and Portugal, as the first colonizers, ended up being the subaltern empires within the Western system, not being recognized and not being economically or politically the center anymore. So the Eastern empires got offsided in a way with the rise of Northwestern Europe, which was what became the economic and the political center. But I would agree that Eastern Europe gets a bit lost in the picture if you speak from an Eastern European point of view. And I guess people speaking from a specific location in Asia, let's say from Goa, who are the people mostly subsumed under the British colonialism, but actually Goa was colonized by the Portuguese, they would say, well, our experience of colonialism was different because we were colonized not in the 19th century by the British, but in the 16th century by the Portuguese, and we have a different experience and a different. So I guess I would plead for more Eastern Europe there, but then of course the picture gets more complex, and I guess more people talking from different regions would plead for taking into account their experience. I think the framework is helpful to take into account a lot of other regions, but of course it doesn't explain everything in 2 hours, which is probably not supposed to be 2 hours.
That's exactly my answer to you. You're asking me a question that will entail another seminar, because I will have to go into 15th century, you see, to explain to you a little about the history of what happened before, you know, 1492. We will have to go into Islamic Spain, we will have to go into the Catholic monarchy, the struggle against the Ottoman Empire in the 15th century, struggles in the Mediterranean. We will have to go over all of that, you know, and watch how the first, once they conquer Islamic Spain, when they destroy the Kingdom of Granada, the Sultanate of Granada, that was the January 2nd, 1492. 8-10 months later, they are in the Americas. Okay, so there is a straight relationship between things that were happening here and the things that happened later. Okay, we need to talk about the struggle between Portugal and Spain. Portugal controlled the markets to the east over the south of Africa. You see, while the Spaniards have no way to go through the south of Africa, it wouldn't take a war with Spain, with Portugal, they can go over the Mediterranean or by land, because that was the Ottoman Empire controlling that side. So they have no other choice than go the other way, you see. And that's when they encountered the Americas, okay? And Columbus thought he has arrived to India. That's why it's called West Indies, you know. And so we will have to go over all these details, the internal struggle inside Europe, the struggle with the Ottoman Empire, the struggle, what was China in the 13th, 14th, 15th century? That was the center of world production. That's why everybody was fighting to control the Eastern market, because China was really the center, okay? What we call Europe today was really a very marginal province in a peninsula in Eurasia, okay? So we will attend another. That's another seminar, okay? I was trying to get into the decolonizing political economy. That's why the focus was this. Now, in terms of Eastern Europe, I would say that, like Manuela, that is a subalternized region inside Europe. And when I talk about Europe, the Europe that became imperial was Western Europe. You know, what we call Western Europe. The rest became subalternized, and as she said, this is, there is a difference between a colonial difference and imperial difference. That is, one thing is that you have been fighting an empire and then colonized that empire and then turn it into colonial difference, what was an imperial difference. Another thing is the colonial difference from the beginning, where you just get to a place and colonize the place without having any conflict with the place, you see. That's important, I think, in terms of many things, because places that were colonized directly without any kind of other imperials or anything like that, I think got immediately inferiorized in a way that is more ambiguous in the places where there was imperial conflict before. You see, because for Western Europe, it was more difficult to argue the inferiority of this other space when before that space was very wealthy and, you know, and very powerful. You see, and so these are let's put it this way: it brings in the racial ethnic hierarchy a configuration where you have, let's put it this way, stratas there that in certain contexts might be pushed into the non-Western, okay, for certain things. Eastern Europe was as non-Western, or for other contexts might be part of the West, you see, depending on which is the conflict. And so it becomes very complicated, and this is what I'm missing, something else there in is the word system concept of semi-periphery. You see? Because I didn't, it would be too long to go into this in this presentation, you see? But there is a middle strata of country between core periphery and semi-periphery, that they are periphery in relation to a core, but they are core in relation to other peripheries. So, you see, it's a relational definition. And so, I couldn't go into all these things in this talk, but I'm glad you raised the question, because I think brings more things to the picture.
Yeah, I would like to maybe refer more to the now and not going back to history. And I would like to ask you, because I think it's very interesting but also tricky, if you go back and with the question we had before, to say, okay, what's the remaining of, or that's Eurocentristic, or these are phenomena, and we still can find them, you know, especially if we talk about hundreds and hundreds of years, yeah, and if we take Africa as in the continent now, if you see the economical power and influence of China right now in Africa, I would like to recall this then maybe more imperial power, or, you know, and then, of course, then other aspects, we have to look to other aspects, but to describe the situation of Africa today, we cannot not include China, let's say. Yeah. We cannot not include China sending soldiers to Sudan just of economic reasons to get oil, let's say. You know, and now we have
sending what? Soldiers?
Sending soldiers. There are 7,000 Chinese soldiers, and the instable situation of Sudan. China said we need to have stability for our economy, and this is not a political act, it's an economical act. And the international community said, okay, you can send soldiers. You know, so I would call that in a way.
But that was UN. I mean, that was part of the division between South and North that was agreed recently, and the negotiation that China came in, etc. You know, so these are agreement. But anyway, the China. That's another seminar, because
I'm talking about how do you call that. Because it's tricky to go, let's say, to a certain country and you say, we are just specifically to say this is Eurocentric or this is religious. The phenomena of Saudi Arabia is Saudi Arabia a westernized country? In some terms, yes. In many terms, no.
And then you are, what
Saudi Arabia is a Protestant version of Islam. That's what Wahhabism is. It's a colonization of the British and the Protestant in the region of the world that carry on into this Wahhabism. That if you see the debates in the Islamic world today, and if you look at the history of Wahhabism, it's a Protestant colonization of Islam. They follow, there's not much difference between this Islamic fundamentalist version and the Protestant Christian fundamentalist that you find in many parts of the Anglo-American world. That they're very similar. And the reason is because there is a history of colonial intervention in that area of the world where Islam was colonized from within. So you have Christian version of Islam. That's part of what you have today. It's a very complex phenomenon. That's what I'm saying. The question of this colonial history and its legacies, it becomes very, very complex. Because now, what we call Islam, we need to now examine what is exactly Islam. Who is Islam? Who is not? These kind of things become very complex. You know, and someone like something like Wahhabism, you know, is really very much a Protestant colonization of that region of the world. And it became a very strong movement in, but it's a minority within the Islamic world.
But economically, it does something. It supports, you know, it's like
They are the intermediaries. That's why they go with the troops to Bahrain. That's why they are the intermediaries of the West in that region of the world, and they have provided oil to the West for a long time, and it's a very important bastion of Western colonial imperial project in the region, you know. And so this is a, so what I'm saying, racial hierarchy, and I think that's one thing I'm trying to emphasize, it's not anymore. In the 16th century, you have the West and the non-West, the zone of being, non-being, geographically marked. Today, we cannot think this way. But that's exactly what I try to explain today, that when you have the elites, for example, westernized elites in Africa might be black, they might be they occupying the position of the Western inside those countries, you see, and inferiorizing other ethnic groups and practicing a colonial power and racial ethnic hierarchies, but not through color, through ethnicity, you see. Or the same thing you could see happening through religion or through other ways of marking this being, non-being, the zone of being, non-being in today peripheral countries. Because today the problem of Eurocentrism is a world problem. The problem of racism is a world problem. It's not anymore a European problem. Because this was carried over several centuries of European colonial expansion. It was internalized everywhere. So you have, in the case in many parts of the world, you know, that's why I was saying that you have inside the periphery zones of being and zone of being, you see, and inside the core zones of being, zone of not being, you see, because these zones are there, you know. Any, you know, it's not that Europe is zone of being and non-Europe is zone of not being, or U.S. is zone of being. No, that's not the way I've been describing the issue here. And that's why I see the South Kingdom, you know, Wahhabi Kingdom, as part of, you know, the westernized elites in that region of the world. It's a form of colonial Islam, you know, that is highly Protestant and tied to imperial projects in the region. If, you know, so this I don't see as something outside what we call Western imperial projects. I see it as part of the zone of being, these elites.
I wouldn't call it outside, but I just thought that I would like to add another word to it, because, you know, we are here, or this very interesting categories you gave us are like categories we already have. And we said we have to intertwine them. They are all influencing each other. And then I just thought about the, what is like another word we can add to, which describes it, because here, as I said, you can really go back to a very essentialist, you know, thinking of something.
Why is it essential, is what I'm saying?
You can, because if you say everything is intertwined and everything is together, then, and everything is referring to Eurocentric Eurocentric view, then not you, but if you use that as a method, it can be the other way around. That happens in research, you know, that's exactly the point. You want to open it,
But on the other hand, you show exactly what you want to open.
Well, what I'm describing here, what I'm trying to describe, is the power relations.
Yeah.
Who is on top, who is below. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Now, you could find the problem with... I'm not in calling power, okay, and naming power doesn't mean that I'm essentializing power, you know, because the way power operates is through essential categories, you see. And so what I'm trying to say is that, for example, if you look at the way the West constructs its knowledge that I mentioned here as normal, no? That's the form of essentialism, and that's an identity politics that is covered under a normal rule. Okay? Now, when I'm calling for the zone of being and non-being, I'm talking about heterogeneous experiences within each zone. So I'm not trying to essentialize the zone. I'm just saying, when you are thinking in terms not of disciplinary knowledge, but in terms of the challenge of for humanity today, what are the challenges we face in the world today, then you know there is a point where you have to name in certain ways the way the power structures work. And that runs the risk of being essentialist, but I'm sorry, I have to use categories to name it. If we start deconstructing all the categories, then power gets lost. And then we become complicit to power. That's why I find postmodernist anti-essentialist rhetoric very, very problematic. Because it's always mobilized to the people who are below in the non-Western world criticizing the West. That's the way it's mobilized. You never hear the use of this radical anti-essentialism mobilized against this hegemonic identity politics that have been normalized to the point where we don't call it identity politics. When we say identity politics, it's the blacks, it's the Muslims, it's the... No, what about the hegemonic identity politics? We never call it identity politics because it becomes the norm. We never call Eurocentrism a form of fundamentalism. You see? We never call Eurocentric binaries a form of essentialism. We never use those terms. You know? It's always... We always use the radical anti-essentialism towards the critics that come from below. And that's why I am very hypercritical of this postmodern trend that I find very problematic, because I see it as a Eurocentric critique of Eurocentrism. You know, because in a sense it's like you mobilize the category of essentialism the moment that people from below start making critiques and using categories to name the way power works. You see, and then it's a way of shutting their mouth, you see. And I see this all over the place. I see this inside France today. I see this inside against the Les Indigènes de la République. I see that in the Americas with indigenous movement, with black movements. You know, I see that everywhere. And the problem is that, as Gayatri Spivak says, there is always a strategic essentialism that you need to, because if not, you don't mobilize politically. And if not, you cannot name anything. Because everything you could deconstruct, you see? You could deconstruct everything. The problem is that if you end up in a kind of radical deconstructionism, radical anti-essentialism, then politically you leave the status quo intact. And that's what I'm saying. That's a Eurocentric critique of Eurocentrism. It doesn't change anything. You just leave the power structures intact. You know, you never are able to mobilize politically, because every time you mobilize a category, it's already deconstructed, you see. And then take the category of woman. That's Julia Kristeva in the 70s, the French feminists. They were using the category of woman, and they were the radical deconstructionists that were saying, no, woman is an essentialist category, let's break it down, blah, blah. And then, so there are moments where you need to use categories and identities that are essentialist, but you have no other choice because you have to mobilize politically. You know, and there are moments when, in order to describe a system of power, you have to use some of the categories of that system of power that might be essentialist, you know, but you have to mobilize just to make it visible, you see? Again, they talk Western, non-Western. You cannot get it more essentialist than that. In fact, that's a very heterogeneous space, and that's a very mobile space there, because some people look at Jewish people in the history of the West. Jewish people in the history of the West were categorized in anti-Semitism until 1945. They were part of the non-West for centuries. After 1945, and with the formation of the State of Israel, suddenly Jewish people became part of whiteness, okay, and became part of the white, so-called white world. And so you have a shift there of people that at some point in history were located as non-West, and another point in history become part of the zone of being. You see, so these are shifting things that you always have to look at in the concrete. You see, that. So I'm not trying to portray fixed locations or fixed definition or anything like that. This is the way the system calls it, but at the same time I'm trying to, in a sense, look at the heterogeneity of the experiences, you see? What we see as a trend over time is that this category of the West and the rest is an organizing principle that whoever is defined in the non-West, okay, and whoever is defined in the West have material consequences in their life existence, you know? But it's a constant in this system. This system has this structure as an organizing principle. It's a constant. Sometimes a group of people might be here and move over here, you see? Other time other people might move. What is a constant is that the majority of the people in the world in this system are in the zone of non-being. And that haven't changed since 1492.
Although I would have a lot of questions myself, and you seem so full of energy. But my impression is that some of us might need the break or something. So my question would be, is there any idea of where we could probably, whether we should have a break at this point of time, or whether it's probably better to go somewhere else, as we did yesterday, and those who want to keep on with the discussion.
Well, there's a workshop planned, so if we have a break now, then we will end the discussion, have a break, and then we have four or five projects that will be presented and discussed. So breaking up would mean maybe we should have a break.
How long?
So four
the last question.
There's one more question. Okay, do you agree to continue one more question? Yeah, okay. So there's one, I'll try to make it short. I think I find it very interesting, but at the same time I think it's all connected to global capitalism. I think you should have talked more about the global capitalism because if you don't have the means to produce knowledge, you don't produce knowledge. If you go to indigenous people, to Africa, to Asia, and if they're thinking about how to survive, not about the notions about how to create our own philosophy, or you know what I mean? So there should be a leisure, the resources to produce this indigenous knowledge, so we can go and ask them, you know, like, so we can learn from them. But if they don't have these means, and this is connected to economic development, dependency, and so on, so I think all these issues are connected directly to the,
yeah, I agree that there is global capitalism, but I disagree on taking global capitalism as the central component. I think this is a civilization, it's not an economic system. I think that what we call global capitalism is an entanglement of multiple power relations that are gender, are sexual, are racial, are epistemic, are cosmological, Christian-centric, pedagogical, etc. Aesthetics is even aesthetics. Even the forms of things that are produced are aesthetically westernized. So this is a long discussion. That's what I tried to argue today, that I refuse to use the term global capitalism, that I prefer to use a longer term at the risk of sounding ridiculous, because I want to basically keep a critique to the idea that in the end is about capitalism. I want to say that it's not just about capitalism. I don't want to throw away capitalism, but I want to think of capitalism as a more complex system than the way Marxists and neo-Marxists have portrayed it. And that's why I think that this is a system that is racial, that is Eurocentric, that is Christianocentric, is Western-centric, is Judeo-Christian patriarchal, you see, is modern colonial, and is capitalist. But the way to think about all of this, I prefer to use a longer phrase, you know, the way to think about all of this is as a heterarchy, or as intersectional, or as, you know, multiple hierarchies entangled to each other, you know, rather than global capitalism, because I think that in itself has led to many, it has political consequences. That I think we have seen already the results in 20th century socialism. And that's why I want to move away from that. Okay, so this is, there is a political reason and a theoretical reason behind of why I prefer to use a different conceptualization.
Okay, so I think we would end here the discussion and then have a 20-minute break and then come back.